I guess one thing that I was struck by immediately was the way in which all of you, to some degree, talked about misreading as a productive concept, which is, of course, also, I think, how much of curating works. Certainly, I liked Angie's description, self-description, as an amateur librarian. I feel like an amateur curator a lot of the time. I mean, it's just a way of stringing together lots of different things that one is interested in. How many of you actually define yourself as artists? Two? No?
Not yet.
Okay. And Angie not? I think you just talk right into it. Yeah.
Just talk into the thing. Okay. Why not? I don't really have a feel for what it means. I guess that a lot of what I do is about trying to understand that.
Why is librarian an easier term to live with than artist?
Well, I qualify librarian as amateur, but I am officially affiliated with an organization called a library.
Right, so. Okay, all right. But you wouldn't be comfortable with the term amateur artist?
That's fine. Yeah.
Okay, amateur artist is fine. And Alex, why not yet?
I think I'd be comfortable with the word artist in French, which means anything from a reality TV show star to a dancer to a comedian, in the sense that I don't necessarily feel like a visual artist. I happen to be in this context now, which is wonderful. Thank you. I spend more, well, all my time thinking about things like Diderot and Aristophanes and Woody Allen, and I think about them not as Woody Allen, for example, as a filmmaker or as a writer or as a comedian, but as all these things rolled into one, and I would humbly like to pursue a path or to think about mediums in that kind of way rather than as a visual artist.
Although with the exception, I guess, of Angie, the rest of you all locate most of your work somehow in connection with art making. Although there, I guess, also many of you have other undertakings that involve publishing or have in the past. But is that fair to say that you see yourselves, or at least you derive the bulk of your interactions with the public from the world of art?
I think it's just a category that frames and enables a certain reading of a work. It's just shorthand for something that allows everything that you were talking about. That's the definition of artist, and in some ways, the ability to talk about something that you're not a professional in some ways.
Well, it's funny, because a long time ago, I remember coming across Susan Sontag, an interview with her describing how she became a writer, and she said, well, I wanted to do everything, so I became a writer. But at some point, I guess, making art superseded that and provided a broader framework or envelope to work in.
No, it's true. There's quite often in the past we've thought about historical epochs and culture in terms of the idea of a dominant medium. I think in the 18th century, the novel was the dominant medium. Anyone who was bright and intelligent and imaginative was going to go into doing that. I think in the early 20th century, it was radio, and then cinema, and then television. And maybe now we don't have a dominant medium yet, but art making in its largest sense, visual arts, could be such a medium because of this liberty that it has, which I don't think it had 20 or 30 years ago, judging by a lot of the performance art that was made back then.
Well, and certainly there are a range of people who perform in an associative kind of logic, similar to your performances, Alex, or even the kind of, I would say, presentation. I don't think it was a performance, Angie. It was a description of how you think or how you work, but it certainly crosses a line into performativity. But maybe some of that, Alex, I don't know if this is what you're sort of getting at, has something to do with a shift in the way digital culture allows us to move between text and image in a rather quickly associative form. I don't know, that something about that, certainly for me as a curator, the way I think is very much related to and infected by the ease with which I can move between things profoundly unmoored from context.
Yes, it's true. I mean, in a sense, the encyclopedic or associative way of thinking has existed as long as there's been encyclopedias, but the difference now is the economy of time and of money, which makes these things a lot easier. Instead of spending 3 hours looking through an encyclopedia to cross-reference and to make a line between the Lindo Man, Celtic mythology, and Adi Dassler, I can do this in 10 seconds, which allows me to be more associative in terms of the accretion of material. One can generate more material more quickly.
But to what end? Like, what does that produce ultimately?
A good point. I think my feeling about the purpose of art is not that art should try to achieve anything politically or aesthetically, but like Borges said, that it should entertain and, if possible, touch. And I think there's something about the manipulation of any medium in a masterful and imaginative way that is touching. I think a lot about, as an artist, the way Wagner wrote about his practice and the way that he criticized people like Mendelssohn and Mozart for very much this argument: why do it? Why have so many notes in your operas, as the Emperor Joseph said to Mozart after an opera? And I think there's a touching beauty in that kind of frisson of activity.
I think that's a bit of an aside. I guess a question comes up, certainly from a curatorial perspective, about sort of what ethically we should apply to these kinds of, qualitatively, how we should, as receivers, but I think also as makers, as producers, how do we decide that one thing is better than another?
Why should we?
Why should we? Well, I guess we don't necessarily have to.
But I don't feel that we really think about this question very profoundly. I think this is perhaps the subject matter of the School for Objects, that we think about these things rather quickly and arbitrarily, using preconceived notions, never really challenging these notions. I think everybody here looks at art as a tool to think about the world and to make the world less frightening and more moving. And I think the amount of energy and effort that artists put into making their own work is required of the audience also when looking and appreciating and thinking about art.
But I would also add that I feel like a connective thread that I've found through all of our presentations and was very excited by in hearing Alejandro and Angie's before presenting is this idea of finding particular interconnectivities, or as you prefaced the Q&A, of thinking about various modes of translation or mistranslation. And I think that if you operate in a space where you're interested in considering those spaces, that it moves away from a qualitative space, because it's more engaged with the fact that at a certain point things overlap or bisect or confuse, and that if it's considered qualitatively, then it creates, that it's like a disruption that isn't productive, because I don't know if you guys would agree with that, but it seems like something that's somehow less interesting to consider. Not that everything should be equal, but that that type of framing, just for me, it seems less interesting.
I mean, another thing I guess that comes up in different ways is the, you know, the thing that Angie described, I think, so well, that the absence of, or the limit of thought or of form to express thought in some way, whether that's linguistic form or, I mean, on some level, I think, Alex, the volume and proliferation of material in your work also somehow gestures towards some of the same things that Angie's talking about. And I guess I also think that, I mean, Alejandro talked about this, the beautiful idea of the index of the absent book, or the book that's never actually written. Somehow every aspect of this kind of way that all of you very differently, but somehow interconnectedly conceive your practices, somehow deals with that limitation, either of the visual or the linguistic or the two together in their ability to describe experience. I guess that's a comment more than a question.
I think that question with the previous question could be considered together in terms of, well, let me throw out this analogy. Think about the opus that is every single Beatles song that's ever been made. I think if we make work that at a certain point is just not crap and is acceptable, and looking at the totality of their work and the way that one might engage with the idea of the Beatles, it's really not about saying what is the best Beatles song, what is the second best Beatles song, what is the third best Beatles song, but looking about everything that they made in terms of interconnectedness, about ideas that were successful and ideas that failed. Their entire practice is like a room or a building that we can walk into and contemplate and think about, and that maybe this is the interconnectivity. It's not just interconnectivity in terms of an artist looking at the world and saying, look at this, look at this, and look at this, but also the interconnectivity between the various pieces that they make that kind of create a totality. And then when it comes to judging, I know it's, for example, Woody Allen has a new film that's coming out now. His latest film may not compare to our favorites from the 90s or 80s, but still we consider it and appreciate it, not necessarily in comparison to a Wes Anderson film, but in comparison to his own work, which I think is something interesting and liberating.
Although it's true that after an hour at IKEA, you want to run screaming from the room. Maybe we should open it up for questions. There are microphones that will wander around, and it's probably easiest to speak into them. If anyone has anything to ask or contribute. Nothing. Oh, sorry, here's a question. Just wait for the microphone so we can hear you. Thanks.
I'm just wondering whether the best might be or might not be the one that moves people, or the most people, the most emotionally.
You mean the question of qualitative assessment turns on how would we measure that?
Well, it would be an individual thing. Different people would be moved in different degrees by different things. And
I think
like
by
a nebulous presentation might be moved by the gentleman on the right. I came late.
He seems
to be moved by when things don't come into a finality but are sort of nebulous, and maybe his anxiety or perhaps something like that becomes awakened when things are too definite or competitive, or, you know, they're evaluated too much, and, you know, he might like the more nebulous and the least specific, and someone else might like yourself might be looking for quantitative, the best, where you could actually put quantifiers to it. By for some reason, because you feel more secure and something like that, and someone else might be moved by something else. I just wonder if that might be the answer to your question.
Could be.
I would say absolutely not.
Okay.
But this sounds weird, because I guess this is the kind of thing we thought about for a long time. From the first moment as a human being, we start thinking about what is a good painting, what is a good book, what makes me happy. Probably the work of art that's generated the most emotion in the most amount of people, if this was some abstract value that we could see in a Google search, would probably have to be the Celine Dion song from Titanic. I mean, let's be honest.
Karaoke favorite of mine.
More tears than the Rothko Chapel, which we were discussing earlier.
Right.
What the answer is, I don't know. This is the beauty of art, that there are no real answers. But
I
can
think
tell
you...
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
No,
I think we're confusing or talking about two things at the same time. One is placing things within a hierarchy, which I don't think is very productive, and then the social function of something. Mm. I don't think it's the same to talk about the Rothko Chapel than the Celine Dion. Because in that argument, you're already placing things within that hierarchy that you yourself are saying is not useful.
Well, what's fascinating is that the social utility in its larger sense of art is completely different. I mean, for all four of us on this bench, we look at this question in completely different ways, I think.
I don't know, because when you started to talk about dominant modes of address, like the novel in the 19th century, it was a dominant mode because it served a social function.
Mm. It still does.
Right, but when you try to locate, like, what is the dominant mode, that becomes a tricky question in some ways, because it presupposes that everybody has the same aim.
Oh, absolutely.
And it doesn't.
Yeah.
I think there's... things need to be defined. I don't believe that everything can be... can remain in this, like, ambiguous place. Mm-hmm. That I think is a little bit what you were saying at the beginning. Mm.
In general, when I think about these topics, my conclusion doesn't tend to be zero or one or black or white, nor is it gray. It tends to be it's black and white at the same time, which can appear to be gray. I don't know if that really means anything.
We had another question here.
About measuring emotion, speak to Descartes. He'll tell you you can't measure emotion. So that's just another opinion. But I have another question for Alejandro. When you were speaking about looking at things in a different way, did you ever consider the misplaced comma, the Delphic oracle?
Not necessarily, but yeah.
It changes the meaning of just changing the place of a comma. Thou shalt return, comma, not in war shalt thou die. Thou shalt return not, comma, in war shalt thou die. It's just by changing the place of the comma, it changes the whole meaning. That's what.
There are other thoughts or questions or comments before we wrap up? Oh, again.
I'd just like to answer the idea about the Titanic. Everybody goes through an Oedipal phase, and the Titanic was an Oedipal thriller because you had the Basso continue to scare everybody. Then you had a young boy going after the senior man's fiancée, and it was like the boy going after the father's mother or the father's wife. And he was in great danger, and he kept each time that the waves would go over the boat, or each time the water would come up, or each time his assistant took out his gun, the audience got a big thrill. And the whole thing was an Oedipal experience, and there was a roller coaster up and down in your emotions. And that's why the Titanic, it wasn't just the music, it was the whole setting, the whole movie and the storyline. So when it comes to a qualifier, the qualifier was the amount of people, the number of people that actually went to see the movie. It was a tremendously high box office. And it produced a great emotional response. And the reason was that it was so widely... so many people go through the Oedipal experience.
And then there's Avatar. Anyway, thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
And thanks to all the artists.